So, welcome to lecture 6 in the fall semester of Marketing 25010, Principles of Marketing. I'm still Dr. Mark. So, I don't know, were any of us alive in 9/11? Was that a couple of us? Yeah, I remember. Well, I probably don't remember. You were just like, anyhow. Although we're going to move on to more fun topics, it's always worth remembering those we've lost on 9/11, it being, of course, a sad memorial and commemorative day. Moving on to more pleasant topics, maybe, is lecture notes, page 47. So again, I never know. Nobody here is a freshman in this course, are you? Anybody here freshman? So if you know a freshman, web students, any of you? If you know a freshman marketing major or a freshman marketing minor, please invite them to our freshman marketing kickball game this Friday, the 15th from 2 to 4 p.m. at the Commons Field, which is over near the May 4th Memorial. Some of us old people will be there. It's probably worth coming just to laugh at me try to run from the kick to the first base, I imagine. And there'll be Kona Ice, if you know what that is. So. Anybody here from Delta Sigma Pi ready to present to me? So we'll pretend I got it wrong and they're coming another day unless they got it wrong and forgot about me. So I'm going to slip over all those slides about who Delta Sigma Pi is and save that for another day. So the next of the mini tests, I explained to you last time, the schedule slid because of our off day and we'd like them to cover two lectures. So the next mini test will open tomorrow at 8 a.m. It will close on the old schedule. It will close on Sunday, 11:59 p.m., and it will cover lectures 5 and 6, which is last Wednesday and today. Any questions on how that's going to work? Clear enough what the new approach is? Also then, opening last Thursday and closing this Wednesday, 11:59 p.m., is the first of the Enhanced Learning Extra Credits, the ELECs off of McGraw-Hill Connect, or, if you preferred, the first of the PACBACK assignments. Either one is due by Wednesday at 11:59 p.m. and you can earn up to 0.3%. Doesn't sound like much to you. Multiply it times 10 and then you've added 3% to your course grade. Any questions about the extra credit? Web students, you're very quiet today. No comments? All right. So, business in the news. BYD is, quote, China's Tesla. And they are coming for the world. China's electric vehicle champion, BYD, has sped ahead in its home market, despite a bruising price war there. Now it will try to export its way to even greater success. So we're seeing a bit about technology and business, a bit about global marketing, and a bit about competition in this marketplace. And then we're seeing corporate growth strategy grow through a market development strategy. We're taking an existing product out to new customers in another region globally. The Warren Buffett-backed Chinese automaker, I didn't really know that, sold 1.8 million new energy vehicles, including plug-in hybrids, in the first 8 months of the year, an 83% rise in sales from a year earlier. The surging adoption of electric vehicles in China has helped BYD overtake Volkswagen as Chinese best-selling car brand this year. To be honest, I didn't know that Volkswagen was the best-selling car brand in China. You probably did, but I did not. So market competition. The company has had impressive gross margins in a highly competitive market. How do they have such great gross margins? Well, they have big scale. They're selling a lot of cars. That drives down unit costs. Better product mix than the competition. And proximity to China's electric vehicle supply chain. And it has a vertically integrated model. Not only do they manufacture the car, but down the supply chain, they actually make their own batteries, a big deal in this business, and that has helped to keep its costs low. So here we're seeing some factors in business success, and a little bit about the relationship we'll talk about on later between costs and profitability. Overseas sales accounted for only 1% of BYD's total sales in August, but as China has become the world's largest electric vehicle exporter, partly helped by Tesla shipping from its Shanghai factory to other countries, BYD is setting its sights abroad too. The company is pushing out new models to Europe, so global business. European car makers will now have to face competition on their home turf from the Chinese rivals such as BYD, and it could be brutal BYD's cost leadership will give it a leg up in the EV transition race. So one of those crushed factors, competition rearing its ugly face. Look out, Europe, here comes BYD. How many guys, bike riders? We have a lot of bike riders here. Not that many. Anybody ride a Trek by any chance? Yeah? If you have an old Trek laying around the garage, I got a fix for you. Guys? You guys need me? Yeah, sure you are. Come on down, the world's best business professional fraternity. 10 minutes late? No, 5 minutes late. All right, web students and in-person students, here we go with the world's foremost professional co-ed business fraternity, and I got to make fun of them for the obvious reason. They're late. I know, it's harassment. You can talk to me about it later. Get on it. Here's this. You have to hold it so the web students can hear you. Here's the clicker. One thing, yeah? Up, okay. You go.
You got to do that. Okay, hi, everybody. Sorry that we're late. We are Delta Sigma Pi. My name is Megan Gidley. I'm the president.
My name is Ben Pachalski. I'm general member.
And my name is Ryan King, and I'm a member too.
So we are the largest and first co-ed business fraternity. Most of this stuff doesn't really mean anything to you unless you're in the chapter, but if you've ever been in the BSA on the second floor and you see that like cafe, in the big cart and usually a big crowd of people that all know each other. That's us. That's kind of our community little hangout.
So as far as professionalism, the LEAD conference, which is the Leadership of Excellence Academies for Delta Sigs, it's kind of puts on events every couple months, and it gives a lot of opportunities for professionalism for a lot of business majors. Along with that, we do professional speakers. We have professors coming in to speak, people who just do different business jobs as well. Resume building workshops and career networking kind of go hand in hand. And there's 18 members of our exec board, which is just different opportunities for you to kind of learn the business of Delta Sigma Pi and stuff like that.
We are partnered with the Ronald McDonald House for our national community service. That's for the whole nationals as a whole. Locally, we're partnered with Akron Children's Hospital. We do downtown and campus cleanups. We did one last night, yesterday morning, before the Browns game, actually, to do a downtown cleanup. We do canine companions, which is where someone watches a dog each, like, for about a couple months and helps them grow up and develop into, you know, dogs. And we also do have NFL drafts as well.
And then one of our last pillars would be brotherhood. So just like a social frat, we have bigs and littles. We do intramural sports teams. We have date parties, formals. Sometimes we do bonfires. But most of the time, every event kind of feels like a brotherhood. Some of the benefits of joining, it's the perks of Greek life without the cost. So our dues are usually under $100 a semester, but in a lot of social fraternities, you aren't going to find something that cheap. We offer a lot of scholarships. Actually, one of our 18 executive board members, she is only in charge of scholarships, finding opportunities for you to get your college paid for and presenting it and then giving you links to apply. We also do a lot with different companies like JD Morgan, for example, comes in and then they talk about their internship opportunities. They look for people to hire and we get a lot of jobs through that. There's plenty of leadership opportunities. If exec board isn't enough, there's national events and leadership opportunities, and then networking.
So for recruitment, we accept all business majors. So for advertising, fashion, merchandising, and healthcare administration and hospitality management, you must have a business minor for that, and you must have 3 remaining semesters at Kent left.
So as Meg said before, the cost of joining for our dues are only about $100 a semester. The time commitment is very small. It's only about 5 hours a week, and that's if you're super active. So like for someone like me and Ben, it's only about 2 hours a week. You can find out more by visiting our website, and the applications are due on September 27th.
This is an example of the pledging process and what you would have to do if you apply. So you would have pledge meetings every Sunday, and that's kind of just to learn the fraternity, what you need to do and need to know. And then initiation would be on November 11th at 1 p.m.
This is our Senior Vice President, Gracie Vincetic. That's her email for questions about recruitment. And then the Director of Recruitment is Chloe Schultz. That's her email if you guys have any questions about anything. And then QR codes at the bottom, the Fall 2023 application on the right, the event reminders on the left, and then those are all of our events for the Fall of 2023.
Any questions for our Delta Sigma Pi professional student group people? It is like a fraternity. They asked me to join 100 years ago as a faculty member. I did, and they actually made me read this silly manual and learn all the secret codes and stuff. I'd tell you about it, but I'd have to kill you. So yeah. All right, thank you guys. Thanks for being here. So Trek wants to sell you a used bike. If you happen to have an old unused Trek bike sitting in your garage, Trek wants it back. Why, you might ask, would Trek want your bike back? In a large red barn in the Wisconsin town where the company first started making bikes in 1976, a team of mechanics is now refurbishing old bikes that will soon be sold online. So they are engaging in socially responsible marketing, ties into what I mentioned before, UN Sustainable Goals, number 12, responsible consumption and production. What we're trying to do is just to extend the usable life of that bike, says their brand manager. In many cases, that may require only a little simple maintenance. As transportation options go, bikes already have a comparatively teeny carbon footprint. But to offset the emissions from manufacturing the bicycle, you need to ride it around 430 miles, replacing trips where you would normally have driven a car. For an electric bike, that number's even higher. By convincing more people to buy secondhand bikes, Trek can make it more likely that each bicycle gets as many miles on the road as possible. So if you're into the idea of recycle, reuse, etc., this is reuse instead of buying new. Of course, it's not uncommon for bikes to be resold locally, but having refurbished bikes prominent on Trek's website and having the warranty from the brand might convince some consumers who otherwise would have bought something new. So we're acting on this as we understand consumers and their attitudes and how maybe to get them involved in a refurbished bike. It's one way for the company to cut its carbon footprint, the vast majority of which comes from manufacturing. We're starting to work on audits of our entire supply chain to find out exactly where we can make the biggest difference. Better materials can help, like aluminum made with renewables. So here's the importance of the entire supply chain if you're being socially responsible in your marketing. And finally, how many of you guys have heard of cannabis? About 10 people. All right. So cannabis is an alternative solution to certain medical problems as well as recreation. As a patient suffering from pain, you can potentially get a prescription for Vicodin, OxyContin, Percocet, or any other opioid during a doctor visit, with physicians in the U.S. writing 143 million such orders in 2020. But rarely, if ever, would the doctor mention cannabis as an alternative to those highly addictive drugs. So here's the idea of social norms and marketing and what doctors will suggest to you. And in Missouri, which has been hard hit by the ongoing opioid epidemic, broaching the idea of a weed for pharmaceutical swap out is also verboten, forbidden on television. That's what the Show Me Organics, a house of cannabis brands, found recently when it tried to air a big pharma style ad called Ask Your Doctor on TV stations in Kansas and St. Louis. So here we're seeing the impact of that crest factor, regulatory, legal, and political influences on marketing. Local broadcasters refuse to accept it, despite rules that now say weed marketing shall be no more stringent than comparable state regulations on the advertising and promotion of alcohol sales, per a new Missouri constitutional amendment that legalized cannabis for recreational sales. Now, there are rules to follow. The script couldn't make any medical claims about weed, but the script did not mince words in its broadside of the often abused pharmaceuticals co-opting the instantly recognizable phrase, ask your doctor. So this is the ad that they couldn't get run on television.
If you experience discomfort, it may be time to ask your doctor about the most commonly prescribed medicine for pain, opioids. Ask your doctor about the 187 opioid-related overdoses a day, or about the side effects that include heart attacks, addiction, coma, death, and moderate to severe constipation. Then ask your doctor about a far safer alternative. This Opioid Awareness Month, ask your doctor to consider cannabis.
Seems pretty harmless, but they couldn't get approval to run it at the local station level. So the 30-second ad with its intentionally cheesy visuals and stereotypical narration dropped some harsh stats, noting that 187 opioid-related overdoses a day in the U.S. and the side effects that include heart attacks, addiction, coma, death, and moderate to severe constipation. So there's the ad theme. Company execs thought they might have a chance at airing the Ask Your Doctor during the evening news programs in the larger, more progressive Missouri cities. The satirical video does not hype a specific product, contains minimal branding in its final seconds, which marketers thought would work in their favor. While 88% of Americans say they favor cannabis legislation, in some form, tight restrictions still exist on marketing. So again, regulatory, legal, and political influences. Despite the network television blackout, Ask Your Doctor campaign has a broad paid media plan with an emphasis on distribution in theater. So you go to see a movie, and there you're going to see that ad. And on digital and streaming videos, all targeted at Missouri residents. So here's the media plan and ways to reach the target audience, even if the local news won't carry your ad. All right, on to lecture notes, page 57, chapter 3, page 84 of the textbook. This chapter was dealing with the issues of scanning the marketing environment. We were thinking about some of those external forces. We were talking about the social forces in general. And in particular, we were talking about demographics, and we were coming up on the underreported white population. You guys have heard of the whites in the U.S., the white population. Over 235.4 million people reported white alone or in combination with another group in the census, the largest population group in the U.S., about 71%, while white only represented about 60%. This group's buying power is about $13.2 trillion, again, a pretty big number in terms of what you might target as a racial or ethnic group. Social forces. These are things in society that drives the norms, values, behavior of our consumers. So we've been hearing about, we've seen, we heard about the UN objectives for sustainable marketing. What are you doing to be green? What are you doing not to pollute the environment? What are you doing to save resources, etc.? Is a cultural trend that's influencing marketing. Healthy living, doing that biking instead of taking the car in. The hashtag MeToo movement has influenced marketers at large, as well as society. LGBTQ plus rights are influencing marketers, as I'm sure you know. The do-it-yourselfers, Lowe's and Home Depot, especially over the COVID time, but still today, there's a big segment of folks who want to do it themselves. Adventurers, folks that want to go out and ride that ATV or want to mountain climb, etc., are a social trend that are out there. The opposite, oftentimes, by the way, in social trends, where there's a trend going one way that can influence business, you'll find a trend going the other way that can influence business. Not up here, but there's folks that are interested in healthy food and weight loss and farm to table. They're interested. And there's also a market over here for luxury chocolate bars, luxury fat chocolate. You get different trends going on. Here, this is the opposite of adventuring. There's the cocooning trend. Stay at home with more creature comforts, home networks, home theaters, texting. Patriotism as a theme is out there, of course. Anti-racism is a theme, of course. But to the extent you look at those yourself and say, boy, what a bunch of liberal hogwash, and why is that driving business? The point is, not everybody's liberal as a target market and in the business world. So not all consumers support these liberal social trends. State Farm Insurance provided support for a program providing LGBTQ-themed children books to teachers and libraries. Conservative groups and some media outlets derided the insurance company as a creepy neighbor and accused it of targeting children with books about gender identity. Hours after a report about the partnership prompted an online uproar from conservatives, State Farm announced it was dropping support of the Gender Cool Project, aimed at helping raise awareness around what it means to be transgender, inclusive, and non-binary. You as a marketer can't have your goals and objectives, but you've got to pay attention to your target audience too. If they're not behind your moves, you have to make a decision about which way you're going to go, and sometimes you want to support what your consumer base wants. Nike faced a fierce backlash in 2018 for its ad featuring Colin Kaepernick, the former NFL quarterback who knelt during the national anthem to protest racism and police brutality. Chick-fil-A, how many guys like Chick-fil-A? The food, yeah. Do you support or not support their political, social norm attitude? They don't support LGBTQ plus rights. They don't support marriage equality. But nonetheless, it ranks America's top brand for food quality, restaurant atmosphere, speed of service, staff friendliness, and overall value. An interesting juxtaposition of quality service and political values. Bud Light sales, I assume we know this, dropped after the beer was featured in a social media promotion by transgender influencer Dylan Mulvaney due to the backlash of the conservative consumers. The point here is, marketers do need to pay attention to their consumers' needs, wants, and values. Just because social norms are moving this way doesn't mean your consumer base is moving this way. Where are you moving with your business? Where are you moving with your marketing, right? So you have to be aware of all the different norms out there. Cultural trends, shifts therein. So, I don't know. Guys, you ready for a nice linen skirt? At only $180, some guy, no? Huh. Well, oh, all right. Well, we got one guy who's on web students. You signing up for that? So again, a small market. I don't know. Are social norms moving that way so men can wear a nice airy sundress in the summer, be comfortable like you gals can? Huh? Economic factors, another external force that's going to impact our consumers and our business that we have to track on, think about, be aware of, and ask how's it going to influence our marketing mix. These are factors relating to things like income, what people are spending money on, their expenditures, the resources that affect the cost of running a business if you're B2B, a household if you're B2C, what's going on with the economy. Macroeconomic conditions are things like inflation, which we know is an issue right now in the U.S., still trying to get it under control. Unemployment, which isn't a big issue right now, a lot of jobs are open. Economic growth or recession? What do you forecast happening? What does it mean for your consumers? What are you going to plan for your marketing mix? I don't know. You have to. Consumer income. How much is their gross income? The amount they're earning each year. Recently, as I'm sure you've heard, consumer salaries have been going pretty well because of low unemployment, and employers are having to pay more to get consumers. I don't know about your consumers in particular, but in general, income's going up. Did I not hear, I think, that McDonald's, maybe, some fast food thing is paying $20 an hour? $20 an hour? For, you know, that sort of labor? Good for them. That's higher than what I used to earn. So what's it mean for your consumers? Disposable income, so what do taxes look like? How much do your consumers have to spend after they have paid taxes? Discretionary income, what do they have to pay after necessities? So even though they have more gross income because of inflation, necessities are higher than they used to be. Is your consumer's discretionary income down or up? You have to know these things, right? So making use of this sort of data is a company called ESRI Community Tapestry. They do a segmentation system that's classified each U.S. zip code based on socioeconomic and demographic characteristics. The notion is that in general, birds of a feather flock together. So people of a high income tend to live near each other in a neighborhood. moderate, low income. Of course, there are lots of exceptions. But maybe wherever you grew up, you can sort of picture the sort of town there was, the sort of neighborhood there was, where the upper income folks lived, where the middle income folks lived. So they said, it's obvious. We should be able to identify people that live in those various neighborhoods and make that information available to marketers. So they came up with 65 distinct market segments for us to think about based on this demographic slash economic information, 14 life mode groups, 6 urbanization groups. Let's see what happens if we pop this up, if it's active today. So this is about their data, data you can trust. And let me scroll down here and see if I can get where I want to get to. Ah, so somebody give me a zip code. Is it going to let me enter? Yeah. Somebody give me a zip code of a place that you know other than Kent, Ohio. Yo. 99505. So let's see if this looks like what you imagine. 99. I don't think that's right. Hold on. Everything's tricky. 99505. 505. So it seems to recognize that. And let's see what it thinks about 99505. So it says that 99505 has a medium, it's called a military proximity area. Does that resonate? Well, military base would be military proximity. Look at the median age here. I mean, the median age of most neighborhoods is not 22 years old. Here's the household size, 3.4 people, with a bit of diversity, 68% diversity. One of the youngest markets, military proximity, is composed of married couple families just beginning parenthood with an average household size of 3.4. The armed forces are the common guard for these consumers. If you were to get that description of a neighborhood, of an area, and you were a marketer of a product or a service, could you begin to imagine the sorts of media you might use, the sorts of themes, ad themes you might use, the sorts of products or services you might use, compared to, who knows Beechwood? Compared to Beechwood, right? Quite a different sort of neighborhood characteristic based on demographics and economics. So that would be a simplified example of what you could find out of this application. We'll return to this again when we talk about market segmentation, but it's an interesting way to think about making use of this data. This goes back a little ways, but it's an interesting use of economic forces and marketing. Let's see if we...
Yeah. The economic
slowdown. No, not you. Go back. You. Maybe I will have to use you.
Today was report card day for the auto industry, and it was a good one. Sales surged in December, capping a fifth straight year of growth for car makers. Analysts expect final sales for the year to exceed 17 million, a figure that hasn't been reached in more than a decade. Cheap gas helped boost sales of trucks and SUVs and luxury vehicles. Today, the price of oil briefly tumbled below $50 a barrel.
Before the bottom fell out of the economy, the car companies, especially ones from Detroit, were addicted to the sales of big trucks and SUVs. When gas prices skyrocketed, the companies nearly lost it all. Well, now we have crazy low gas prices, and consumers are gobbling up SUVs. Jeep, for example, was one of the biggest winners as consumers picked crossover SUVs. Its sales were up more than 40% for the year. At the same time, hybrid sales and alternative vehicle sales took a hit in 2014. Even though some of the hunger for bigger cars has picked up, maybe Detroit executives have learned a lesson from their near-death experience. They haven't forgotten yet.
What you cleared out of the system in the last 4 or 5 years was 40 or 50 years of accumulated, perhaps bad behavior.
Painter says even though bigger vehicles are more profitable, today's cars, no matter the size, are far more fuel efficient. Stephanie Brindley with IHS Automotive says, This 17 million is much healthier than the last time the industry hit 17 million cars a year. She says the industry has learned a very basic economic lesson.
The automakers in general have shifted to adjusting production for demand overall. So what will happen now is that if an auto manufacturer is seeing a vehicle not performing to expectations, they can adjust the number of vehicles that they produce.
So if gas skyrockets, then she says car makers can in theory shift from making big SUVs to making small cars. Meanwhile, Michelle Krebs with Autotrader.com says consumers only save a few hundred dollars because gas is cheaper. That's not enough to send them into the dealership.
People keep focusing a lot on just gas prices, but that's not the full picture. There's a big economic picture at play here as well.
Krebs says the health of the auto industry comes not as much from cheap gas as from an improving unemployment rate, improving consumer confidence, low interest rates, and
credit was widely available, and we saw a big increase in leasing. So that made vehicles available to more people on a wider spectrum of credit worthiness.
Krebs says the business model for car makers has changed in the last decade. Car makers can turn a profit selling far fewer cars. Krebs says she expects consumers and car companies to enjoy the cheap gas while it lasts. Sonari Glenton, NPR News.
So I'm fully aware this is not 2015. I'm fully aware these are not the factors that work right now. But the principles are the ones we're talking about. The importance of understanding what are the economic factors that are going to impact your business. Is it just gas prices in this example? No, it's gas prices, it's unemployment rate, it's consumer confidence, it's the interest rate, it's credit availability. What do you think about today that's relevant to your particular market share? And I love this comment about the old auto industry. They've learned a very basic economic lesson: adjust production for demand. And my comment is, duh, sitting on a marketing 25 advantage. Really? But they took a long time to learn that lesson because they had gotten away with other behavior over time. So this is in the B2C world. Let's take a look at our friend Felber and Felber from the B2B world.
The economic slowdowns, we've been through several of them. This particular one, as it hits raw materials and fuel costs and petroleum-based products, is hitting everywhere. And it's hitting a little faster. The larger clients that we work with are getting ahead of the curve. Some are feeling the pinch right away. Others are anticipating feeling the pinch. So what can we learn as a small business from this? A, it's affecting our clients, it affects us. It may affect us a little more dramatically down the road, but what we're trying to do is find ways to help them. And this may mean that the current services we're providing them now might need to be put on hold, and we may need to address other things that we can help them in the immediate need. For example, if they're really pushing for sales and we're working on public relations and public relations is generating leads, but sales doesn't have literature to fulfill, maybe we need to focus our attitudes. And that's happened in some clients where we've really need to hone down what do they need right now in this particular setting. So adjusting to our clients' needs is important. And what we're learning is that our job is going to be to have some more foresight on the next slowdown or the next major turn, whatever that event may be, and try to anticipate what our clients are going to go through. That's what will add value down the road for our clients.
So again, he's talking about a particular recession time a little bit ago, but what's happening next? Is there a recession coming? Isn't it coming? We still seem open to that question. Or is it going to be a turnaround? What are you doing to plan for these upcoming changes in the economic environment and how they're going to impact your B2C or B2B customers? Technology. Obviously, technology is having a huge impact on business and marketing. It impacts consumers, their choices, what they consider to be of value. Oftentimes, we find that due to technological increases or improvements, we have reduced costs of manufacturing, whatever the thing is we're talking about, selling electronics, for example. And so consumers now focus on other attributes. Are you prepared for them to be focused on something other than price? What other value are you bringing? What features are you offering compared to the competition? Technology is changing so fast that we're getting lots of introduction of new products very quickly. The typical example here over and over again, of course, is Apple rolling out a new device every year? Something like that, very quickly due to technological changes. Changes in production, technology helps us to increase our recycling to be more sustainable. Do your consumers care about that? Does it impact your marketing mix? No big surprise that the electronic business technology, the market space, has had a big impact on business. This is the information and communication-based electronic exchange environment where physical boundaries no longer interfere with buy-sell decisions. There are lots of industry-specific market spaces where we have an integration of marketplaces through sophisticated computer and telecommunication technologies. This is not necessarily we go click on Amazon and try to buy something. This might be constrained to an industry group or constrained to you and your suppliers where you're communicating with one another. In a market space, information and or physical goods are exchanged and transactions take place through computers and networks. E-commerce, you obviously you're aware of e-commerce. Has anybody not bought something online yet? Not. Has anybody not bought something online? So obviously, massive impact before COVID, even more massive during COVID as people wouldn't leave their houses, they were quarantining, and everything was being offered and bought online. True in the B2C world, true in the B2B world as well. The intranet, a big deal. Extranet, an extension of an organization's intranet that's intended to users outside the organization, usually their partners, their vendors, their suppliers, and they're isolated from all other internet users as they share important information on inventory, production, costs, plans, and you want to be secure. That information is not to be leaked out to the competition. So these technological forces are impacting marketing and business. During the COVID, it affected technology, of course, for retail. E-commerce is arguably the most significant retail digital transformation ever. COVID-19 forced retailers to invest more money into new technologies, implement those technologies much more quickly than they otherwise planned to do, and retailers that had not yet started to sell online quickly had to transform their business or go out of business. The coronavirus accelerated e-commerce growth trends significantly. U.S. e-commerce penetration jumped to more than 25% in 2020 from 15% back in 2019, pulling forward several years of adoption of online sales in retailers compared to what would have been expected. So here's digital channel used for the first time during COVID-19. So live chat, interactive voice, video, voice, in-app, SMS, etc. So it did impact our society, our cultural norms, our behavior, our use of technology in a variety of ways. This is funny, when I click it, it works. Now, this may be less funny because I don't know if everybody knows who this business expert is that I'm about to show you. But this is a well-known businessman talking about the impact of technology. See if you know who he is. Now, see, it's funny if it just works.
Okay, well, we can do questions. Okay. Very good. First hand up.
Sir, as a company that primarily distributes paper, how have you adapted your business model to function in an increasingly paperless world?
We can't overestimate the value of computers. Yes, they are great for playing games and forwarding funny emails, but real business is done on paper. Okay? Write that down.
So how many guys do know who this guy is, what he's from? So he's a comic on a show called The Office that was on a while ago. And his intern has asked him to come in to talk to his MBA class. So he goes in to talk, and he's talking about, you know, the use of technology and how have you adapted. And he says, well, yeah, sure, I've heard of the internet. I'm a paper company, though. I've heard of the internet, but it's useful for silly things. Write that down. And what's the entire MBA audience doing? They're typing on their computers. My point here is you will run into this in your real-world career. There will be managers who will look out there, see the thing we're talking about, whatever that thing is, go, yep, that's got nothing to do with us. Yeah, it does, or at least it very well might. So the teaching point, that's exactly what happens. Some managers will see the stuff we're talking about as marketers, warning them about, tell them to plan for, and then ignore it. I just put this in because it's amusing, because it is a paper company, and there is actually some technology at work in the world of everyday paper. Dunder Mifflin was a paper company. Imagination comes boldly to life with Astrobrite's papers, ideal for use at work and home. Choose among 23 vibrant colors in a variety of sizes, weights, and assortments. Let your ideas soar with the possibility of Astrobrite's technology coming to your everyday paper supply and being marketed. Competition rearing its ugly face. One of the crest factors, competition, regulation, political, legal, economic, social, technology, competition. Those are those other nasty firms out there, firms, organizations, people, that would love to take your consumers or your clients from you. And how would they do that? Looking to see what you're doing, and then providing better satisfaction to your consumers than you can do, than you want to do, than you are doing. So hey, why would somebody switch to another competitor? They're taking better care of them than you are. Your success will come from finding a better way to satisfy your consumers, not by focusing on your need to be competition. What is your competitive advantage? Why should anybody care about you? What are you bringing to the table? Do that better, and you will be competition. So trying to be competition is the wrong focus. Satisfying your consumers better is the right focus. So what sorts of competition is out there that we have to worry about? Well, more than you might think of right away, but let's think about the different forms of competition from maybe micro-econ, where I guess they talked about that, yeah? So first of all, we have what's called pure competition. Pure competition is where you have a large number of sellers of the product or the service. The things you're selling are essentially commodity products. They're all very similar to one another. And so you really don't have an ability to brand it, to make it different than anybody else's. So distribution is very important, letting the marketplace know you're out there. Anybody have a micro-econ example about pure competition where these characteristics come into play? Maybe remember micro, pure competition? Lots of entities selling a commodity product. Yeah. Back to the farm. So what is your favorite brand of wheat? What? It's a commodity. It's wheat. I don't buy wheat, but I don't know a brand of wheat, right? So indeed, we're talking about agricultural products. Not canned corn, but the farm. Corn, wheat, soybeans. These folks are competing against a whole bunch of other people that are making corn, wheat, soybeans. It's not branded. How are you going to brand your soybeans is a bit different than that farmer's soybeans. So what's really important is getting the product out there to the consumer. Pure competition. Monopolistic competition. In this case, there are many competitors in the market. No one firm has significant control over the market price because they're not big enough. Each company produces a similar product, but they aren't identical. They're not commodities, so some differentiation is possible. So you have a fairly large number of sellers of these kinds of products. The products are somewhat unique. You have special characteristics to them, but you're replaceable. Substitutions can occur. And so pricing can be important in the marketing mix. Examples include restaurants, cereals, shoes, shampoos, toilet paper. Large number of sellers. Yeah, sure, the product's unique, but you could substitute, I don't know, Northern toilet paper for Charmin toilet paper. You would be okay. And so you have to watch your competitors' price in monopolistic competition. Oligopoly. Here, the market is dominated by a few sellers. You have a few very large competitors that have the majority of the market share out there. The products often are relatively similar. And in this case, promotion is the key to demonstrating your product differences. For example, the beer industry. there are really only two major producers, Anheuser-Busch and Miller. Of course, there are a bunch of little independents. The health insurance market is run by Anthem and Kaiser Permanente. And again, who are my video gamers? Anybody still video gaming a bit? Yeah, yeah, what's your console? What do you use? PlayStation. So, I mean, what do you got? You got Microsoft Xbox, Nintendo, Sony PlayStation, and that's mostly it, the big players, okay? So you have a few large competitors. The products are relatively similar, and you want to promote your product to demonstrate the key differences so consumers will get you. Finally, move to a pure monopoly, okay? Single producer, selling a unique and unsubstitutable product. And in this case, you don't really need to do much marketing because the only place to get the product is from you. What is your memory of the example of pure monopoly from perhaps Micro? Pure monopoly, one seller, non-substitutable product. Yeah. Which one? Standard Oil. No, I would say not, because I think Standard does have competition as I think about it from, again, I don't know what all they own, but you've got Standard Oil, you've got Exxon, you've got Safeway. I don't know if they're all the same one, but okay. I mean, they're big. They're big. Yeah, I saw a hand here. New pharmaceutical drug can have a monopoly over the short term. Yes, the more standard example, and I have no problems with that one, are utilities, right? So, were you thinking about that one? So, utilities. So, tell me this, riddle me this, Batman. You don't want to buy water. You're going to show them, what are you substituting for the water you're not buying? Hard to take baths in beer. So, water, natural gas, the electric companies. Now you can counter-argue with me that, well, you could get a solar panel. Yeah, you could. It's a teeny, itty-bitty part of the marketplace, but I guess you could say that. Mostly a monopoly. So what you mostly see these folks do is not market, if at all, to grow use. If they do any marketing, it's to demarket. Use less water. Use less electricity. They don't want to build extra plants. So where does your company operate? What form of competition does it operate within? This is just a graphic saying the same thing. Pure competition, monopolistic, oligopoly, monopoly. Number of sellers varies. Product differences vary. And the importance of marketing mix, pure competition, distribution. Monopolistic competition, pricing is important. Oligopoly, promotion is key. Monopoly, it's just not that important because they can't get it anywhere else. Now, as you think about competition and your consumer, you recognize the following obvious statement. Consumers have limited buying power, yeah? They can't afford everything. If they could, I guess they could buy everything. It wouldn't matter what the brand was, right? And as a company, as a brand, you've got to compete for those limited dollars. How are they going to buy from you? You have to compete at the brand level, called brand competition, against those companies that are selling the same type of product as you are selling. You also have to compete. Oh, all right, we'll hold here. So at the brand level, Colgate is competing for your dollars against Crest, who's competing against Church & Dwight, Arm & Hammer, toothpaste. These companies are different companies, all competing against one another for your important toothpaste dollar. Somewhere there's a brand manager worried about how much Crest is being sold today, yeah? So that's one level you have to think about competing against. But you also have to recognize that you're competing for consumers' dollars at the product level. Here we're selling products that can be substitutes for one another at that level. So, for example, someone might spend their money on Cleveland baseball, either tickets or maybe a season ticket. So what would compete with something like a baseball season ticket? What else could someone buy at that sort of level of competition? You're not buying a different baseball ticket in Cleveland. So what might be at that level of competition, for example? Yeah, so I might spend my sports dollars over here, or I might choose to spend it over here at that level of competition. So Cleveland Browns, said in the news. Or for a different segment out there, but at the entertainment level, maybe they're buying season tickets to the Cleveland Orchestra, or on the lower end for entertainment dollars, maybe they're spending money on streaming, Netflix or Sling, or their PlayStation. So here's the entertainment level, not brand level, but you're competing for consumers' dollars at that level. What's going on there? And then we have the company level, right? So in some sense, when it comes to spending dollars, people have to decide, are they buying sporting goods in general? Are they buying clothing in general? Are they buying transportation in general? Are they donating to charities in general? So there's different levels of competition that you have to be worried about. What's going on in your company's domain across these levels of competition? So given all of this, how does a firm compete successfully in the marketplace? Well, your goal, your company's goal, your brand's goal, is to find a differential advantage, what we would call the unique selling proposition. And the question you're asking yourself here is, if you went out of business today, would anyone care? Would anyone miss you? And if most people aren't going to miss you if you're gone, you probably aren't offering much special to them. You probably aren't going to succeed very well. Having gained that differential advantage, that unique selling proposition that makes you special and people care about you, you have to work to maintain it, and that's hard. Competition changes. Consumer tastes change. Technology product offerings change. So having gained it, you have to keep it, and that's hard. There is, of course, a tendency to want to ignore competition, right? We're doing okay, we got a business. Why should we really care about what else is going on? The wine industry in Italy for a long time resisted making changes against competition. Let's hear about them.
From food to wine, Italy has finally signed on to the global trend toward wine in a box. That's right, the Department of Agriculture, Food and Forestry has authorized producers to package some wines in non-glass containers. Ray Isle is deputy wine editor for Food and Wine magazine. He joins us from New York. Thanks for being with us.
No, thanks for having me.
It sounds like this was a long debate in Italy. What finally changed their minds?
Well, many things are a long debate in Italy. What finally changed their minds, I think, was a realization that they weren't going to be able to compete in a global market, which is what wine has become, without changing some of these traditional restrictions they have on regional wines. Because box wine is without any question a wave of the future. I mean, its percentage of the wine market keeps increasing with every passing year. What's interesting is that the real shift has been towards higher end box wine, and this is exactly what this Italian decision represents. What you won't see are wines like Brunello di Montalcino, Barolo, Chianti Classico, which are truly the most famous Italian wines. You will see wines like Rosso Canero, Dolcetto d'Alba, Rosso di Montalcino, wonderful wines, just not the absolute premier top of the heap.
What are the numbers here? How much of a demand is there now?
Well, there's a tremendous demand for boxed wine. You know, in some markets, like in Northern Europe, let's say, where Italy does sell a lot of wine, you know, it may be 50% of the market.
Okay.
In the U.S., I forget where it is exactly, but I think it's in the sort of 9 to 12% at this point and growing rapidly. And one thing, you know, one reason that boxes are immensely popular with wine producers is that they're much cheaper than bottles. It's about, you know, a factor of 10 to 1 in terms of packaging cost.
Is there no downside, no weird aftertaste from that bag?
Well, you wouldn't want to do it for a wine that you're going to age over time. You would eventually, I can only assume, get some kind of chemical interaction between the polyethylene bag that's in the inside the box and the wine itself. So definitely wouldn't want to put your first growth Bordeaux in a bag inside a box. But for, you know, a kind of wonderful, you know, juicy, friendly Dolcetto Alba, why not? And what you're also going to start seeing are Tetra Paks, which are like juice boxes.
Don't tell the Italians.
Yeah, it's a slippery slope once you start on this box thing. You'll find your wine in all sorts of containers. I got an aluminum tube full of wine the other day at work. Sort of an interesting twist.
What are these Tetra Paks like?
Tetra Paks, I mean, if you think of a juice box and then expand it to a 1 liter size, it's similar to a box of wine, except that it doesn't have the plastic bag inside. So it's really like a, it's almost like a milk carton of wine. They're very, you know, eco-friendly. They're recyclable. They have, you know, much less of a carbon footprint. You can flatten them out once you're done with them. And the virtue that a box has over a Tetra Pak is that inside that plastic bag, there's no air. And when you open the spigot and pour yourself a glass of wine, the bag shrinks down as the wine goes out, and there's never any air in it. So the wine actually lasts quite a bit longer than something like a bottle or a Tetra Pak. You can have, you know, open your box of Rosso di Montalcino, and 3 weeks later, it'll still be good.
No straw on that Tetra Pak?
Believe it or not, I think I did see an Australian Tetra Pak wine that did have a straw cup with it.
Those which, Australians.
You know, the Australians, whatever the trend is, they're going to be out way in front of it.
Well, Ray Isle, thanks so much. Well,
thanks for having me. Thanks very much.
Ray Isle is Deputy Wine Editor for Food & Wine magazine.
And so here's a real-world example of an industry group looking at the trend coming, and for a long time saying, that's not going to affect us. That's not important for us. Wait a minute, 50% of the market's gone to boxes? Let me get into boxes. Finally, they recognize the need to change what they're doing against competition and their unique selling proposition. Anybody old enough to drink wine? Anybody had wine in a box? Tastes like wine. I mean, it's wine, you know? So, new wine packaging, innovation in packaging seems to be well accepted by Americans. 49% growth rate of wine in cans, 37% wine on tap, 18% wine in a Tetra Pak, 15.2% in a box, 7.5% growth in plastic. Considering that most of these containers, with the exception of boxed wine, are relatively new to the U.S. market in the past few years, though they've been available in other countries for years, this growth is pretty significant, pretty, if you will, amazing. In 2020, cans and convenience were very important, with outdoor activities on the rise and the desire for more convenience. Wine in cans, Tetra Paks, and plastic containers will continue to grow in the U.S. 2020 canned wine actually grew 61% in dollar growth, according to Nielsen, causing a can shortage in the supply chain. Small bottles and large box formats also gained in popularity, growing at 53% and 31% for these different sizes. So this is an area ripe for innovation as packaging designers try to figure out new and attractive ways to sell wine in bottles, cans, Tetra Paks and plastic containers. Technology at work, competition at work, changing norms at work. You got to change or you're going to be gone. Thank you. Political and legal forces. So this is the regulatory, political, and legal forces. For me, you take an entire thing on business law, whatever we call it. So I'm not going to go into much here. The book will cover it. So for whatever test comes up, you should be reading it. I guess the next test. Monetary and fiscal policies, including government spending, affects us. Social legislation and regulation, which we've alluded to by now several times, anti-pollution laws. Regulation to compete, to prohibit monopolies and constraint of trade is happening, varying depending on the particular political party in power. Right now, the interesting one who's following the discussions about, is Google a monopoly? Anybody following this issue? Yeah, so it's an interesting question. Is it a monopoly? Is it a monopoly in trade? Does it harm the consumer? Do you guys know, a long time ago, Bell was Ma Bell. It was one big company. Are we aware of this? And then they broke Ma Bell up into a bunch of baby Bells because they decided it was monopoly. And they literally broke the company up into separate entities throughout the country. Is this the future for Google? What will it mean for technology? Who knows how that's going to play out? Consumer protection, regulation of food and drugs, and protection of consumer rights. Protecting competition, product-related regulation, all of these things are out there, and we have to be aware of them all. Nutritional labeling, Product Safety Act, Consumer Profession, Production Safety Commission, consumerism at large. Current trends in economic and politics. The U.S. economy is expected to slow. Inflation is an issue. The Federal Reserve continues to tighten monetary policy. If inflation is more persistent than expected, the Fed will need to tighten more, which will further slow the economy. I think they're on hold just today. Most workers' wages have failed to keep up with inflation, although they've grown, but there's still erosion in some purchasing power of households. Consumer spending, which accounts for about two-thirds of the total gross domestic product. That I should underline, if you don't know it. You guys, consumers, are two-thirds of the total gross domestic product. If you're not spending as consumers, the economy is going to tank. We're going to be in a recession. So we often hear about consumer confidence and how that's doing. It's trying to forecast if you guys are going to be spending money or not. The odds of U.S. economy falling into recession next year, they're saying, is greater than 50%. We'll see what happens, of course. What does all this mean for your company? What will all this mean for marketers? Time will tell. All right, so this is the idea of those external factors impacting our business, our consumers, and the need for us to track on it, pay attention to it, and ask what it's going to mean as time goes on. Takes us to chapter 4. Ethical and social responsibility in marketing, which, if I have it right, is page 65 in the lecture notes. I wish I didn't have to do a chapter on ethics in business, ethics in marketing. I wish that people didn't lie, didn't cheat, didn't steal, and just did things ethically. As you would guess, that's not the case, unfortunately, which brings up the need to talk about this stuff. So, anybody have a course in ethics from high school or college? Taking it now. Okay, so as soon as I say something that doesn't agree at all with what ethics at the college level is teaching, throw something at me, but nicely in an ethical way, because I'm curious if it would agree with what you're being taught now. So, ethics involve the moral principles and values that guide the actions and decisions of an individual or a group, a society, right? So what are the moral principles and values of the U.S. society? Business ethics, then, involves what's right and wrong in the workplace and hopefully doing right. Unethical business behavior can get you investigated, not pleasant, fired, not so hot, or fined and jailed. Actions do have consequences. On the other hand, some managers, some people say business ethics, that's just stupid. Who needs it? You don't need it because really ethics is religion. It's not business. Or, hey, our people are ethical, till they're not. Or it's only for philosophers, it's not for business people, it's obvious, do good, or it's preaching, or it's just a recent fad. Or interestingly, ethics can't be managed. Mull that one over for a second. A statement by managers that's thinking about their employees, or business partners, or supply chain, ethics can't be managed. And where's my, you're taking the course right now. So, from your 3 weeks of vast experience taking ethics at the college level, what would your response to that be? Ethics can't be managed. Pro, con? Ethics is knowing right or wrong. Oh, there is no right or wrong. Okay, what I think is ethical, you may not. Maybe that's why people do wrong, because they say, cheating the consumer, that's ethical. Why shouldn't I do that? So I wouldn't quite go with your college level course myself so far. Who else would have a thought? You're going to be a manager one day, yeah? Do you think ethics can be managed? Yeah, Webby's, I can't hear you. Oops, we got an answer down here. Hold on. Anybody know CPR? Okay, what you got?
It absolutely can be managed. We have codes of ethics, and there's over in business, you have to sign like waivers and all sorts of other things to show that you're going to be not sexually harassing your coworkers.
All right, so here we have an answer. Yes, it can be managed. How many people would buy that? Yes, ethics can be managed. How many people buy the opposite? Nah, you really can't manage ethics. Buy the other side. You're allowed to raise your hand. And then the other people are sleeping, I guess, the rest of the Webbies, what do you think? So here's what I would say. I cannot manage what you think. That I cannot do. You may think it's right or wrong, good or bad, okay or not okay, but what I can manage is what you do on my job. I can manage your behavior. I can manage by watching you, by having controls over you, by having you sign the paper, by reading the code of ethics. I don't know what you think, but I can manage your behavior, is what I have to say about that, or fire you. It's the same as social responsibility, so we don't really need it. If a firm's not in legal trouble, it's ethical. Managing ethics has little practical relevance. Maybe, but let's look at some examples where that didn't quite play out and some management was necessary. The first examples are pretty old. Nestle's, how many people know Nestle's? How many people think it was a pretty good company? Yeah. So Nestle's a while ago, a bunch of years ago, had an interesting idea. They said, what we would like to do is help mothers in African countries come up to speed. We would like to sell them infant formula, powdered formula, which is what everybody in Europe, a lot of people in Europe use, the US use. How many people see a problem with that? That's bad on the face of it. How many people say, yeah, that sounds okay so far? Okay, so what they do is they take the same approach as they were using in Europe and the US. They give new mothers at the big hospitals a little baby package thing in which they had some powdered milk to use. So far, so good? No, that's terrible. Good? Terrible. All right. So now you have these mothers, often from poor rural villages, coming to the big city to have their kid. They look around and they say, oh, this is what modern people must do. They must use powdered milk. That's what I should do. So they take the powdered milk back to their village. Do you suppose most rural African villages have really nice, clean, filtered water supplies? They do not. Do you suppose powdered milk is free? It's not. So now what are you going to do if you're a mother in a poor rural? You're going to mix it with dirty water. And to make it last longer, you're not going to use as much as you should. Can you see where this is headed? So inadvertently, I hope, Nestle's ended up harming a lot of infants in Africa. Not their intent, I don't think, but nonetheless a poor choice. Somebody might have foreseen it. So that became a big issue for them. Enron was busted for having conflicts of interest. Ken Lay, who presided over the Enron accounting scandal, died before serving his prison term. WorldCom NCI was busted for running inflated accounting reports. We'll hear about this later on, influencing one of our video guest lecturers. Bernard Edwards of WorldCom served half of his prison term for fraud, dying shortly after his release. These things have consequences. Martha Stewart, how many guys know that she was busted and went to jail for insider trading? She's a strange case, man, because she came out of jail and she's running a great business. It didn't seem to influence her badly, but at least she did jail time for doing bad things. Bernie Madoff, do you guys know Bernie Madoff's story? Ran a pyramid investment scheme that robbed in big ways, massive ways, retirement funds, individual communities, charitable organizations, just screwed them all over en masse, was convicted. He died in 2021 while serving a 150-year prison sentence, and his kid committed suicide, perhaps in part because of his father's bad behavior. Volkswagen, as you may have heard, cheated on their emission tests such that it made their tests look like they were better, had less emission than they did. They paid $14.7 million. How many of you guys heard about the Fry Festival? Yeah, not that many folks. So the Fry Festival, Billy McFarland put together a fake, never implemented festival. He was sentenced to 6 years in federal penitentiary in 2018. In 2022, was released and moved into a halfway house. He put together fantastic ads for something that didn't really exist.
Hey, y'all, this is Ronte. And a little thing I love about the Chick-fil-A honey pepper pimento chicken sandwich is the richness of the pimento.
Here we go.
The actual experience exceeds all expectations. It is something that's hard to put in words. All these things that may seem big and impossible are not. It gives people that type of energy, that type of power.
Wow, two transformative weekends? At a place looking like that, where do I sign up? A bunch of people signed up for a lot of big bucks. There was a physical location. It had nothing on it. It was essentially a bunch of huts. I don't know if they had any outhouses. It was a total fraud. He went to jail. Wells Fargo opened fraudulent customer accounts. They were had an $185 million fine. They had a $5 million refund to customers. Thousands of their people were laid off. Stunningly, in December 2022, they were ordered to pay another $3.7 billion for illegal activity, including unjust foreclosures and vehicle repossessions that used to have a brand name. They used to matter. Now they're trying to recover. I see that's not hot anymore, is it? Yeah. All right. Now they're trying to recover from this terrible PR.
We know
PR.
The value of trust. We were built on it. Back when the country went west for gold, we were the ones who carried it back east. By steam, by horse, by iron horse. Over the years, we built on that trust. We always found the way.
Until you did.
Until we lost it. But that isn't where the story ends. All it's right. Where it starts again. With a complete recommitment to you.
Yeah.
Fixing what went wrong, making things right, and ending product sales goals for branch bankers. So we can focus on your satisfaction. We're holding ourselves accountable to find and fix issues proactively. Because earning back your trust is our greatest priority. It's a new day at Wells Fargo. But it's a lot like our first day. Wells Fargo, established 1852, reestablished 2018.
Great PR piece, not quite implemented ethically at the top, I'm sorry. And more, Cy, the founder, CEO John Kapoor, and the four top execs at the pharmaceutical company Insys were found guilty in a scheme involving bribes and kickbacks to physicians who prescribed large amounts of fentanyl spray to patients who didn't need a painkiller. He's serving 5.5-year prison sentence. Elizabeth Holmes, the founder and CEO of the failed blood test company Theranos, sentenced to 11 years and 3 months in the Fed for her role in committing a years-long fraud. So my comment, which is a little tedious by now, don't lie, don't cheat, don't steal in the classroom, in your personal life, or in business, because it has consequences, for goodness sakes. Oh, if I didn't have to say that. All right, I think I've preached enough for today, and this is the end of the material for mini test 3 coming up. Details to follow, thank you.